From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a look at the Iranian Revolution through the eyes of a young girl, a girl who was forced to wear the veil at the age of 10, but still found ways to party and listen to Iron Maiden. Marjan Satrapi has written a memoir called Persepolis. She tells her story in the form of a comic book. Also, a talk with guitar god Jimmy Page, one of the founders of Led Zeppelin. Their two DVD set, featuring remastered footage from several 1970s concerts, has been described in Rolling Stone as the holy grail of heavy metal. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the debut short story collections of two new young writers, Jane Average and Mary Yukari Waters. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. President Bush has arrived in Egypt for talks with Israeli, Palestinian, and Arab leaders this week. At a photo opportunity in France before his departure from the economic summit there, Mr. Bush said he is committed to getting all sides to comply with the U.S.-backed roadmap for peace.
My country and I will put in as much time as necessary to achieve the vision of two states living side by side in peace.
Mr. Bush meets with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas in Jordan on Wednesday. Days after announcing it was relaxing restrictions in the West Bank, Israel placed Ramallah under curfew and has closed its main checkpoint into Jerusalem. Israeli forces reported a number of threats of Palestinian attacks. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
As Prime Minister Ariel Sharon prepares for Wednesday's summit meeting with President Bush, Israeli forces retightened their closure on some parts of the West Bank and Gaza and placed Ramallah under curfew for the first time in weeks. Israeli security forces cited a rise in alerts of possible Palestinian attacks. In the northern Gaza Strip, a bomb went off near a tank, causing no injuries or damage. Israel increased the number of work permits for Palestinians traveling to jobs in Israel, but Israel Radio reported fewer than a third of those allowed to leave the Gaza Strip did so Monday. Israeli forces continue to surround most Palestinian population centers. Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas traveled to Jordan for meetings in advance of the Aqaba summit. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The Italian Prime Minister said at the G8 summit that President Bush says he has no intention of attacking Iraq. At the same time, a foreign ministry spokesman invited American companies to bid for contracts to build nuclear power plants in that country. Federal marshals have moved serial bombing suspect Eric Rudolph from North Carolina to Alabama. A judge ordered that Rudolph stand trial in Birmingham for a deadly 1998 bomb attack at a clinic that performs abortions. Then he'll be tried in Georgia for three other bombings. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports.
Rudolph appeared briefly before the federal judge and did not oppose the government's request to move him to Alabama. Shackled and wearing a bulletproof vest, Rudolph said little during the court appearance, but before and afterward he met for several hours with his new court-appointed attorney, Sean Devereaux. Devereaux said Rudolph admitted no involvement in any of the bombings and offered no explanation of how he evaded a massive manhunt for 5 years. The lawyer said he found Rudolph articulate and thoughtful.
He's been portrayed some over the years in the media as some sort of zealot or fanatic, and he's not.
Rudolph faces 23 federal charges. If convicted, he could receive the death penalty. Adam Hochberg, NPR News, Asheville, North Carolina.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 47 points to close at 88.97. Trading was heavy on volume of 1.7 billion shares. The Nasdaq fell 5 points to end the day at 15.90. You're listening to NPR News. U.S. Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz is in Japan on the last leg of his East Asia tour. He has been visiting with key leaders in the Pacific region to discuss the possible restructuring of the U.S. military presence in South Korea and the nuclear crisis in North Korea. From Seoul, Dwali Saikau Tao reports.
Before leaving for Japan, Wolfowitz summed up his two-day visit to South Korea.
The essence of what we're trying to do is to make sure that the forces we have here on the peninsula can respond quickly and immediately, even before reinforcements arrive, if there were ever to be an attack.
Saving lives, that's the goal of strengthening deterrence on the Korean Peninsula, he says. But like South Korean President No Moo-hyun, he admits intelligence on North Korea's nuclear weapons program is imperfect.
We know what they say. We know some things that can verify some of what they say. We don't know everything.
Wolfowitz also confirmed that a substantial amount of money is being invested to improve and enhance defenses on the Korean Peninsula. For NPR News, I'm Duahli Saikautau in Seoul.
Congressional lawmakers opposed to loosening restrictions on media holdings criticized today's FCC ruling that allows large companies to acquire more TV and radio stations. South Carolina Senator Ernest Hollings, the top Democrat on the Senate Commerce Committee, is co-sponsoring legislation with Mississippi Republican Trent Lott to retain the current limits on media ownership of stations. A study in this month's Journal of the American Dietetic Association concludes many of this country's parents and children are misinformed about what causes childhood obesity. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News, in Washington.
The NPR Shop features shortwave, AM/FM portable radios, and other gift ideas for dads and grads at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You'll be surprised by what it was like for Marjan Satrapi to grow up in Iran during and after the Islamic Revolution. She tells her story in the book Persepolis. It's a memoir which uses the form of the comic book. Satrapi is an artist who now lives in France. Her illustrations have been published in newspapers and magazines. Satrapi was born in 1969, 10 years before the revolution. Her family was prosperous, educated, and westernized. Her great-great-grandfather was the last emperor of Persia. Her parents opposed the Shah and had friends and family members who were imprisoned by his regime. They all rejoiced when the Shah was overthrown, but the rejoicing didn't last long. Many of those friends and family members were soon among the enemies of the new Islamic government. Satrapi had attended a bilingual co-ed French school. Both co-ed and bilingual schools were shut down after the revolution. She was 10 when the Islamic government made it mandatory for women and girls to wear the veil. One of the images that you've drawn for your new book describes what it was like after all the girls and women had to wear the veil.
Yes.
And in the illustration, one of the kids is strangling another girl with her chador, and is saying, "Execution in the name of freedom." Another girl is putting the chador over her head and saying, "Ooh, I'm the monster of darkness." And another girl is saying, "It's too hot out." So did you play with the chador like that and you know, strangle friends with it and pretend
it
was a costume and act like kids do?
Well, yes, it's not because, you know, they push you to do something or you have to do it, because the situation in Iran is that if you didn't wear that on your head, you couldn't go to school. And if you were a grown-up and you didn't have that on your head, you would have gone to jail. It was not the choice of people. That was like that. So we didn't believe in it. And as soon as we could take it off or play with it or making it look ridiculous, we did it. And the Iranian women, they did that really during the time. That means if you see from the very beginning of the revolution until now, each year, you know, the women, they gained about 1/2 inch of hair and they lost about 1/2 inch of chador on their head. And today, you know, they show more hair than they would show the piece of tissue that is covering their hair. So it is something changing. And that means also that, you know, this thing was really an obligation, and in no way that was the choice of Iranian people.
During the Iran-Iraq war, Iran was bombed by Iraq. Your neighborhood was bombed. In fact, a house on your block was hit, and one of your good friends was killed. You say in your book that you were really changed by that, and it made you fearless. Why
Yes.
did it make you fearless?
When you see that your friend who is 13 years old, she can die, then you say, I can die also. I mean, of course, you know, when you come back to where you are and you see that, you know, people that you have known, they are gone, of course you have a very bad conscience also to say why you should have survived and why should she die, you know. If at this moment, you know, when the bomb explodes, is a question of the tenths of an inch is nothing really. So it could be my house. I could have died. So after that, you know, I think I accepted that I was already dead. So from the moment that, you know, your death doesn't matter anymore to you, then you're not scared, you know. all these people that they died in my country to defending the country, to defending freedom, justice, in the war, whatever. I don't know in what sense my blood would be a little bit more red than theirs, you know. My life doesn't worth more than theirs, so I'm not scared.
So when you stopped being scared, what are some of the things you started doing that you were too afraid to do before?
Well, you know, I just came out and I always said what I think. After that, I never swallowed my words. I never hid myself. I always thought what I think. And, you know, it doesn't matter anymore, you know. It doesn't matter. So if you know, people, they don't agree, if they agree, you know, all this hypocrisy of hiding the thing to please to everyone and, you know, just want to save my skin and everything. I did another way to save my skin was that I left my country in 1994, definitely. But until the time I was there, until the time that I could speak and it had an effect, I spoke and I still do that. That was the effect of that.
When you stopped being afraid, were there rules you started breaking at school? Did you talk back to teachers? Did you refuse to pray when they asked you to?
Oh, yes, I even hit the director of the school, you know, because she wanted to take my... I had a little bracelet in gold my mother gave me, and she wanted to take it. And, you know, they were just robbing things from us that was stealing. And I say, I don't give it. And she wanted to take it by force, and I beat her.
Your fist?
Oh, no. I just, you know, I just pushed her away and... Well, she was like, you know, this wimp style, so she fell down and, you know, well, I didn't push this hard neither, but she fell down and that was a crisis and they threw me out of the school and it was a whole story to find another school and everything. But, you know, I don't regret it one second. If I had to do it again, I would have pushed her even harder. You know, I should just add something. All these directors of the school during these years that I was in the school, they gave the student to the guardian of the revolution, and many kids between the age of 14 and 18, they have been killed in the prisons because of these directors that gave the children. So, you know, probably I would have beat her much harder than what I did.
Who were the guardians of the revolution?
Well, you know, you had the army, you had the police, and then you had another style that was this guy who were dressed like rangers, and they had big beard, and, you know, they were here to make order. And, you know, they were the law themselves, you know. They could stop you because they feel like stopping you, telling you that your scarf was not right or you spoke too loud, or why is it four people gathered together in the street? That was a time in my country, in 81, in 82, that, you know, people, they have been shot down in the street because they made a little demonstration, you know. The thing they have very, very, very much changed. I'm not talking about of Iran of today. I hope that there won't be any confusion. But at the very beginning of the revolution, it was like that.
Now, at the same time that you were rebelling against the authority figures in your life, like your teachers, who represented the Iranian revolution, you were also rebelling against your parents.
Oh, well, that was the age, you know. That was the age. I was like 13, 14 years old, and, you know, I had to confirm myself because I was getting tall and, you know, I was realizing that I was a human being myself and, you know, I was not anymore just the child of my parents, so yes.
Yes, you're right, you were rebelling against your mother's dictatorship. what was she strict about?
Well, you know, because my mother, she was a real dictator and she still is, you know, from the second that the school, for example, they closed. She was convinced, and I thank her so much today, she was convinced that the only way for me to get out of this whole mess was to be very well educated. So, you know, the school finished every day at 2 o'clock. Every day she came to pick me up at 2 o'clock. 3 days per week, I had French courses between 2 and 8. So that was 3 days. Then 1 day per week, I had some German courses because I was going to go to Austria. Then I had 1 day of karate courses, even 2 days. And then the only day of weekend, which was the Friday, I had painting courses. And the rest of the time, when I came home after 8 o'clock, when we arrived, it was almost 9, I had to sit and do my homework until 11. So And my whole family was saying to my mother, but you are mad, you're going to kill this child. And my mother said, nobody die from reading or learning. So this child is not going to die, and we are in a hectic situation. And if tomorrow she has to leave the country, she has to know everything. The more languages she knows, the more she knows how even to defend herself bodily, self-defense. If she knows how to draw, whatever I give her, that's a new chance for her to be able to do something outside of this country. And she was right, because, you know, I learned, you know, not to be lazy probably and to work hard after that.
When it became easier a few years after the revolution for people to leave the country for visits, your parents took a short trip to Turkey, and they went by themselves. It was just like the parents went and you stayed behind. And they brought you back gifts, and the gifts they brought you were the kinds of Western things, pop culture things that you couldn't possibly have gotten in Iran. They got you a denim jacket. They got you an Iron Maiden poster.
Yes.
And they had to smuggle it in. They had to figure out creative ways of smuggling this stuff into Iran. What did it mean to you to have that?
Oh, I was the coolest person in the whole school. Imagine, I had a big poster of Iron Maiden and a large poster of Kim Wilde. Nobody had such a thing. I was the only one. And of course, you know, I was inviting my friends coming home, watching my poster and being jealous at me. I was very, very happy to have those. Though, you know, afterwards, everybody had a friend who was in Germany or somewhere else, and they were folding the posters into a letter and sending it to their friend. But I had big posters. Another one, they had smaller posters. So it was something. But again, you know, my book is also to show that, you know, that's not because you're Iranian that you're listening to revolutionary song against the West the whole day, that, you know, the pop culture right. belongs to everyone. It's not because you're Iranian that you don't know who is Iron Maiden or who is Kim Wilde, or, you know, the culture in general belongs to everyone. There is no frontier, you know. Your Edgar Allan Poe belongs as much to it belongs to me as much as my poet Hafez in Iran belongs to you. That is the heritage of all the human beings.
In now that you're older yourself, looking back, do you think that your parents were wonderful or crazy to have almost risked their lives to smuggle in the Iron Maiden poster and the denim jacket? I mean, if they were discovered, not only would have the stuff been confiscated, they probably would have been seriously punished.
Well, I think that my parents, they were wonderfully crazy. That is, both of them. They were wonderful. And they were crazy, but they wanted so much to make me happy.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, they didn't really risk their life. I mean, probably they would have, you know, take my father's passport for a month and, you know, just finish with the poster and these things. You know, it was not really a life risking, but it was a risk anyway. But, then I was happy for 1 year, and I think that... It's worth that for them, of course.
My guest is Marjan Satrapi. Her new memoir about growing up in Iran is called Persepolis. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Marjan Satrapi, and her new book, Persepolis, is a graphic novel about coming of age in Iran during the Iranian Revolution. When you were 14, your parents sent you to a school in Austria.
Yes.
Why did they want you to leave the country, and why did they choose Austria as the place for you to go?
Well, you know, I was too much outspoken. I was just, you know, talking all the time. And you should know that in these years, they really stopped no matter who. I mean, in the Iranian prison, you had kids of 15 years old, 16 years old, 14 years old. You had all the ages, and this kid, they could be executed. So, and then it was bombed every day. And, you know, when my parents, they had just one child. And, you know, they were always so, I don't know, I mean, my mother always said, you know, I will love you so much that you should go. And she always thought that, you know, the parents, that they keep their kids close to them, they're just egoistic. And the real love is also always to give enough possibility to your kid to go. And that was the reasons they sent me abroad. And why Austria? Because Austrian, they give very easily the visa. And my mother's best friend was in Austria. And, you know, their life was not so expensive. And that was a very good French school in Austria. That's why I went to Austria.
Did you feel like your parents were rejecting you by sending you away? Did you understand why they wanted to send you away?
Oh, yes. At this time, I understood it very well. But then when I went to it in Austria, and I was so misjudged because, you know, now I am the axis of evil. But in these years, in the very early 80s, you know, I was Khomeini myself. You know, all the Iranians, they were so much misjudged, you know, by this, you know, I was escaping something, and people, they were judging me, but by the thing that I escaped myself. And it was so hard. And, you know, when you are 14, 15, 16, you don't have any friends. And, you know, you don't have your parents. And everybody judge you and everything. So I just cut completely with my country. I just wanted so badly, you know, to assimilate the Western culture that, you know, I've just forgot who I was myself. And I went back to Iran because of this reason, because I was just too finished, too tired for that. And that is just much afterwards that I understood that to assimilate another culture, first of all, I have to assume my own culture and to assume who I am myself. And then I can open myself to the other ones. And that made me go back. And at this time, I was kind of angry to my parents, you know, because I thought that it was a rejection. But it didn't last very long, you know.
You returned to Iran when you were 18. Intending to go to college there. Did you stay that long?
Oh, yes. I stayed for 6 years in Iran, 5.5 years like that. I made the master in visual communication. You know, I got married, I divorced, I worked, I did all sorts of things. And that is only after that that I came back in 1994 to France. But this year that I had in Iran, first of all, I was so happy to be in Iran. And I can tell you, I never partied as much as I did there, because since there, you know, party was forbidden and everything was forbidden. With the students, we were just together almost every night, making a party every night, because first of all, it was forbidden. And then we lived in such a repressive society that the only way to have a balance in our personal life was to have a big freedom in our personal life.
Where did you hold the secret parties, and what were the parties like?
Oh, like the parties that you have here with more sophisticated people, because, you know, again, you know, whatever is forbidden, you make it even more. For example, you know, now United States, for example, is forbidden to smoke. I smoke 3 times as much as I do in France, where I have the right to smoke. So that's the nature of the human being. So it was held in the apartments, for example, in my apartment, and everybody came, and you had this Rolling Stone music, and you had Deep Purple, and you had, I don't know, whatever you can imagine, you know, from, I don't know, whatever. And, well, we were drinking alcohol and dancing and shouting and all of that. But at the same time, we were risking to be arrested, and we have been arrested 1 billion times. I mean, how many times haven't I been arrested because of the fact that I was in a mixed party with my friends, and then they came and, you know, they stopped us, and we were one night in the jail, and the day after, the parents, they had to come, they had to pay, we had to sign a paper saying that we will never start to make party again. But we did it. You know, life continues.
Would your neighbors call the police?
Well, once in a while, unfortunately, they were the neighbors, but also in my neighborhood, we didn't have any neighbors saying this. But once in a while, just, you know, the cars of this Guardian of the Revolution just cross around the city, and they see, you know, one window lightened with people, and, you know, then they, you know, they just watch, and they ring on the door to check, and once in a while there's a party, yes. But of course it is, you always have also bad neighbors, you know. Human being is pervert.
Are your parents still living in Iran?
Yes. And they do.
What is their life like now? Are they living with fewer restrictions than they used to?
Oh, no, you know, the situation in Iran has very, very much changed. You know, in the two, three last years, for the first time in the history of Iran, we have a free press, although, you know, they will close a magazine one day. The day after, this same magazine come out under another name, but it continues. We don't have, you know, there's still a few journalists in the prisons, but they are not executed. They are in the prison, which is, I mean, between being in prison and being executed, it's better to be in prison. So that is an evolution. And so, no, the situation has very much changed. You know, you have much more freedom. And this that's a real change in Iran. It is, the situation is absolutely like not like it was before. It doesn't mean that, you know, it's the best country in the whole world and, you know, we have so much freedom, we don't know what to do with. But it is not absolutely not the way they show it to us, and certainly not like it was in the beginning of the 80s.
You're still an Iranian citizen, even though you live in France. Was it difficult to get a visa to come to the United States?
Yes, I had to stay 2 months, and then I have kept for 1.5 hours in the airport. Yes, it was very difficult.
So you kept for 1.5 hours at the U.S. airport?
Yes, yes, and you know, I mean, the security things is something, but, you know, it's a limit not to pass. And, you know, you cannot talk to people, look down at them just, you know, because of an Iranian passport. Unfortunately, I couldn't answer because I had to have my stamp to be able to come in.
Right. Did you show them your book and say, this is who I am?
Yes. And I showed them even, you know, the invitation from my editor, etc. Then I had to swear on God that I was not lying, fingerprints, you know, photo from the side, from the back, whatever. So it was difficult, yes.
Were they impressed by the book and the letter from the editor?
They didn't look at it even. Okay. They were interested, that was my passport. And so, you know, my evil side.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Marjan Satrapi's new memoir is called Persepolis, The Story of a Childhood. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Toms of Maine, maker of natural care products and creator of the Rivers Awareness Program to preserve the nation's waterways. Information at participating stores or tomsofmaine.com. And from Wiley, publishers of The Iron Triangle, Inside the Secret World of the Carlyle Group, Dan Briady's investigation into the intersection of big business, government, and defense, available wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, heavy metal guitar god Jimmy Page. There's a new Led Zeppelin DVD set. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews two new debut collections of stories.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Two new short story collections take readers from war-torn Japan to a vision of Manhattan's Upper West Side filled with witches and banshees. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Every semester, I warn my writing students against relying on the old comparison-contrast essay format. You know what I mean. Jay Gatsby and Captain Ahab, alike but different. It's such a predictable way of organizing material. So I hope none of those ex-students are listening now as I say that Mary Yukari Waters and Jane Avrich are two young women, both short story writers with exceptional debut collections that are, well, alike but different. I surrender. Sometimes the truth lurks in cliches. Which is what I feared Mary Yukari Waters' collection, The Laws of Evening, might turn out to be full of before I read it. Waters was born in Japan and moved to America when she was 9. She's half Japanese and half Irish-American. The 11 stories in her collection focus on women's lives in a chaotic Japan during and after World War II. I initially wondered if the fact that Waters had no firsthand knowledge of wartime rationing and bombings and life in an occupied country might make her go for stale observations borrowed from old war movies. Not to worry. Waters' empathic imagination is so vivid, she makes a reader feel like a silent witness to the small acts of cruelty and surrender that the history books can't record. Many of the women in these stories are remembering the war in the tranquility of their old age, which gives The Laws of Evening a melancholy tone, sometimes leavened with gallows humor. In a story called Since My House Burned Down, an old woman, displaced by her tomato sauce-wielding Americanized daughter-in-law, almost fondly recalls resorting to eating raw chicken sushi during the war. In Shibusa, one of the most moving stories here, the atmosphere of grief is unalloyed. In a prologue to the tale, the narrator recalls how, as a girl, she excelled in the ancient rituals of etiquette. Her elders told her, however, that her graceful bows lacked something, something they called shibusa, which roughly translates into sorrowful sentience. Later, our narrator marries and moves to Japanese-occupied China with her young husband, a business executive. They eventually have a son. In 1941, they return to their hometown in Japan. One day, when the woman is standing on a rationing line across town, bombs fall on their neighborhood, killing her family. Remembering that loss and the humiliation of a post-war encounter with one of her husband's former colleagues turned fish peddler, the narrator realizes that she and so many others in her generation have attained shibusa, sorrowful sentience, which is also what graces the stories in Waters' collection. The 15 tales in Jane Avrich's debut, The Winter Without Milk, are also mindful, especially of telling details, but wickedly so. Listen, for instance, to this description from the story Life in Dearth, where the narrator reminisces about her seaside childhood among economic and emotional tightwads. My aunt feared charity as much as my uncle. She would not accept so much as a spoonful of sugar, even if a neighbor had barrels to spare. Whatever was missing from a recipe, she'd supplement with sand. Her cakes and pies were granular and lump-hard. Her pudding smelled of the sea. At Christmas time, her gingerbread cookies had pebble noses and seaweed hair. Random bites could chip your teeth, but you had to gag and bear it. Without a smidgen of fainness, Avrich stirs lots of literary allusions into her distinctive stories, some of which read like wry nightmares. Take Literary Lonely Hearts, which describes the travails of a man who signs on with a dating service that matches men with their ideal fictional heroines. His, regrettably, turns out to be the undependable Hester Prynne. Lady Macbeth and Cathy Earnshaw also make direct appearances here, while in the story called La Belle Dame Sans Merci, a young woman named Matilda attempts to seduce her neighbor, a married man with an ill wife, by slipping lines from Keats's spookier poetry under his door. where the stories in The Laws of Evening make their impression on a reader through the gentle, inexorable buildup of sadness, those in The Winter Without Milk are hectic, dramatic, and spiteful. Both collections live up to the promise of their elegantly odd titles.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Laws of Evening by Mary Yukari Waters and The Winter Without Milk by Jane Avrich. Coming up, Led Zeppelin guitarist Jimmy Page. This is Fresh Air. In the late 60s, Led Zeppelin became the prototype of the heavy metal band. As the Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll says, the band changed the landscape against which rock and roll is played, and so the basic formula for heavy metal was codified: blues chords plus high-pitched male tenor vocals, singing lyrics that ideally combined mysticism, sexism, and hostility. Led Zeppelin broke up in the early 80s. Now Led Zeppelin has a new 2-DVD set, which features excerpts of 4 concerts, as well as interviews and TV clips. A review in Rolling Stone described the set as the holy grail of heavy metal. Jimmy Page co-founded the band and became one of rock's guitar gods. Before Led Zeppelin, he played with the Yardbirds. He joined the band shortly before Jeff Beck left. Last week, while I was away, guest host Barbara Bogave recorded an interview with Jimmy Page.
Before you joined up with the Yardbirds and before the whole Led Zeppelin thing happened, you were an established session player in London. You played with the Kinks, with the Stones, with Donovan, with Burt Bacharach. What did you learn from session work that you used later in both playing and producing in Led Zeppelin?
Well, I've got to tell you that what it was really was an apprenticeship. But the reality of it was that the session musicians were actually in London a very, very closed shop. It was very, you know, it was just like the creme de la creme, really. However, they needed somebody who really knew exactly what was going on with all the music of the day and the source music of it and everything, and also somebody who could come up with his own ideas. And I played on a record anyway, and it got in the lower end of the top 20. And all of a sudden, this sort of behind these closed doors of the creme de la creme, there was like, who's that guitarist on that record? And I was brought in just initially to play exactly what I wanted to. They said, just play what you want. They gave me the chord charts, and it was really fun. You can imagine that, you know, it was good. And then bit by bit, they'd give me like a few dots on, you know, look like crows on telephone cables, you know. And I realised that I'd have to start reading music. So I started to read music. I was doing all these. I'd be doing 3 sessions a day, 5 sessions a week. So that's 15 sessions. Sometimes I could be playing with a group. Sometimes I could be playing could be doing film music. It could be a folk session. And you know, the thing is that because I listened to all this sort of music, I was able to fit all these different roles. And they probably thought that was really quite cool. And after a while, my ability to read music improved and improved and improved. So really, I just became quite an accepted member within this very privileged society, you know.
Was it the session work and the time that you spent in the studios that got you interested in the technology and producing records?
Oh, yeah. being this apprenticeship that became part of the reading of music, it also became part of how things were recorded. You know, I started to learn microphone placements and things like that, what did and what didn't work. I certainly knew what did and didn't work with drummers, because they put drummers in these little sound booths that had no sound deflection at all, and the drums would just sound awful. And the reality of it is that a drum is an acoustic instrument. It relies on, you know, having a bright room and a live room to it. So, or at least a booth or whatever. And so bit by bit, I was learning really how not to record.
I'm thinking that Led Zeppelin is one of the first bands to really have an ambient, to a band that recorded its ambient sound. I mean, it sounded as if someone was playing drums at a party when you listened to Led Zeppelin records. Was that the sound that you were going for?
Well, certainly so that the drums could breathe. One of the marvelous things about John Bonham, which made things very easy, was the fact that he really knew how to tune his drums. And I tell you what, that's pretty rare in drummers those days. He really knew how to make the instrument sing. And because of that, he could get so much volume out of it just by playing with his wrists. You know, it was just an astonishing technique that was sort of pretty holistic, if you see what I mean. But as far as the drums went, right from the first recording, it was given a lot of space so you could get the ambience of it. But it was there, as far as my end of it went, there was always great attention paid to where the drums were going to be, and whether you could hear all the harmonics from them. And also the one that, for instance, like Levy Breaks, was something where we were playing in one room in a house with a recording truck, and a drum kit was duly set up in the main hallway, which is a three-story hall, with a staircase going up all around the inside of it, in a big house, you know. And when John Bonham went out to play the kit in the hall, I went, oh, wait a minute, we've got to do this. And we just, curiously enough, that's just a stereo mic that's up the stairs on the second floor of this building, and that was his natural balance.
Well, let's listen to that. This is When the Levee Breaks. Jimmy Page is my guest, who's co-founder lead guitarist for Led Zeppelin. Listening to When the Levee Breaks, Led Zeppelin. My guest is Jimmy Page, the co-founder and lead guitarist for the band. Now, the term heavy metal didn't exist before Led Zeppelin. When you first heard the term heavy metal, what did it mean to you, and is that what you thought you were playing? I mean, the band started out as a blues rock band and had a slow evolution.
Yeah, I'm not really sure where we got a tag of that, but there's no denying, I mean, the fact that the elements of what became known as heavy metal is definitely there within Led Zeppelin. But the reality of it is that it's the riff music, and riff music goes back to the blues, the electric blues of the 50s, you know, and what was going on down there in Chicago. And that's it. You know, it's curious. Actually, it's said that it's William Burroughs who first termed it in the book of The Heavy Metal Kid, is one of the characters, you know. When he did an article in the 70s with me for a magazine called Crawdaddy, and at that time I was really honored that he'd been to Zeppelin concerts, and he'd been to a few. I was really quite surprised because I didn't know, but he'd asked to interview me, and at that time he said, you've got to go to Morocco, because that's where you're going to, he said, what you're doing is trance music. Well, I knew it was trance music without any doubt, but he said, you've got to go to Morocco because that's where you're going to hear you know, riff music. But you know, it was a good call, and I went there, and I understood exactly, you know, why he asked me to go there.
When you say you knew it was trance music, was that the effect you were going for, or is that what you felt when you performed it?
No, that's just exactly what happened with it. Uh-huh. It was trance music.
in terms of the relationship between you on the stage and the audience.
And all of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, within what was being played and what would emanate from it, you know, in every way. But yeah, it was definitely trance music. There's no doubt about that.
Now, Stairway to Heaven. Stairway to Heaven, you wrote in 1970. What was going on in the band at the time that you wrote that song?
Well, we were recording at Headley Grange, which was a house where we were staying. But we had a recording truck, and it was a really, really good working environment, you know. And I had these pieces, these guitar pieces, that I wanted to put together. I had a whole idea of how, of a piece of music that I really wanted to try and present to everybody and try and come to terms with. It's a bit difficult, really, because it started on acoustic, and as you know, it goes through to the electric parts. But we had various run-throughs where I was playing the acoustic guitar and then jumping over and picking up the electric guitar. And Robert was sitting in the corner, leaning against the wall. And he was, as I was routining the rest of the band with this idea in this piece, he was just writing, and all of a sudden he got up and he started singing, along with another run through. And he must have had 80% of the words there. And why I'm saying that story is I just want to let you know just how inspired we all were at that point in time. We were inspired by each other, you know.
Now, your guitar part, of course, the introduction is one of the most famous acoustic guitar bits in rock. That and maybe Freebird. It's what all aspiring guitarists play. And I think every guitar store in the world has a sign requesting that you please not play Stairway to Heaven when trying out the instruments.
Yeah, but would they permit me to do it if I went in there?
Did you ever ask? I was going to ask.
No, I won't ask. Stairway denied.
Was the lead in something that you had fiddled around with on your own? And were you looking
what,
for...
I'm sorry?
Was the lead in something that you had fiddled around with on your own when you picked up...
Oh, no, that was part of one of the sections that I had. You know, as I said, it was a number of sections that I wanted to join together. Mm-hmm. And, I had that bit. Oh, I had that well and truly before I went into Headley Grange, yeah. The whole thing about Stairway was that it was something which... Going back to those studio days for me and John Paul Jones, the one thing you didn't do was speed up, because if you sped up, you wouldn't be seen again. You know, everything had to be right on the meter all the way through. And I really wanted to write something which did speed up and took the emotion and the adrenaline with it and would reach a sort of crescendo, you know, and that was the idea of it. And that's why it was a bit tricky to sort of to get together in its early stages. But no, I had these sections and I knew what order they were going to go in, but it was just a matter of getting everybody to feel comfortable with each sort of gear shift that was going to be coming.
Well, we've got to hear it now. This is Jimmy Page, Led Zeppelin. This is my guest. Here's Stairway to Heaven.
All that glitters is gold, and she's buying the stairway to heaven. When she gets there, she knows if the stores are all closed, with a word she can get what she came for. She's buying a stairway to heaven. There's a sign on the wall, but she wants to be sure, 'cause you know sometimes words have to mean.
Stairway to Heaven, Led Zeppelin. I'm speaking with Jimmy Page. He's a co-founder and former lead guitarist for the band. I think virtually everyone in my generation, at least at one time or another, made out to Stairway to Heaven in a rec room somewhere, or made out while someone played Stairway to Heaven on a guitar on a beach.
Well, please, I wasn't the guitarist playing Stairway to Heaven when you were making out. I'm really relieved at that.
I'm curious what stories fans tell you about that song. what it means to them, what memories they
well,
have?
Well, you know, the wonderful thing about Stairway is the fact that just about everybody's got their own individual interpretation to it and actually what it meant to them at their point of life. And that's what's so great about it. Over the passage of years, you know, people come to me with all manner of sort of stories about, you know, how it meant, well, what it meant to them at certain points of their lives, how it actually got them through some really tragic circumstances or to the other point where, you know, because it's an extremely positive song, you know, it's such a positive energy in it. And you know, people have got married to that.
We're listening to an interview that Jimmy Page recorded with Barbara Bogay for our show. There's a new Led Zeppelin DVD set. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview that Fresh Air guest host Barbara Bogave recorded with guitarist Jimmy Page. There's a new Led Zeppelin 2 DVD set.
When you were a kid, first learning guitar, did you have a song like Stairway to Heaven, the song that everyone played and a lot of people played it to impress girls at parties?
I don't know. I didn't used to go to parties.
Did you listen to music with friends or was music something private?
Playing guitar was, because to be honest with you, when I grew up, there weren't many guitarists, there weren't any. There's one other guitarist in my school who actually showed me the first chords that I learned, and I went on from there. So it's something, I taught myself the guitar from listening to records. So, yeah, obviously it was a very personal thing. You couldn't sort of bring your friends around and have a dance party and suddenly start playing guitar and say, well, hang on, I want to move that back and listen to that solo again, you know. So it's just the way that it was.
Who did you listen to? What music did you listen to?
I listened to the early rock of the 50s, you know, sort of Elvis, which is such an important inroad, really. From the musicians that were in all of that, you know, and the bands that were relative to that. I mean, I was gobbling it all up. I was trying to take on board as much as I could. Johnny Burnett, Rock and Roll Trio, Gene Vincent, all of these things, and bit by bit, one began to access the blues, because they were playing 12-bar blueses, and then you became open to listening to sort of, you know, Muddy Waters and Elmore James and Robert Johnson. It was like doing, I guess it was almost similar to doing a university course, you know. You were just learning and learning and learning, and at the end you came up with your paper. And I guess my paper was Led Zeppelin.
Led Zeppelin really hit it big on the first and second U.S. tour in 1968 and 1969. And somewhere in there, the band became a full-fledged happening with the whole groupie scene and Rolls Royces driven into swimming pools and girls camped out in hotel corridors and some very intense groupies. I think Squeaky Fromm, I think, turned up at some point in there, the girl who attempted to assassinate Gerald Ford. So
that must have been one of Robert's fans, wasn't one of mine.
At the time, what was your attitude towards the whole scene?
What for me is the most important thing, and always was, no matter what. That's the whole reason of going up on a stage and never knowing exactly what was going to happen from the moment you walked on to the moment you walked off musically. So much importance seems to be put on what happened to Led Zeppelin when they weren't on that stage, that I find it quite amusing. But if I'm just going to, I just want to explain, you go up on stage and play for three hours and a half, and you've got, you know, you've got all this, you're not just turning on an adrenaline tap here, you've got floodgates going. And the thing is that when you come off stage, the one thing you don't do is go home and have a cup of cocoa and go to bed. And then we would go to clubs after that. And for us, clubs, the energy of a club was actually coming down from the intensity of those shows. So that's what I'm going to say. And have a good time, Barbara.
You toured with the Black Crowes a few years ago. How did that touring experience compare to your memories of touring?
Well, I had a wonderful time with the Black Crowes. It was just a fantastic party, to be honest with you. It was great to play their music. I really loved it. And actually doing the Zeppelin music with them was quite an experience because, for example, we did 10 Years Gone, and all of a sudden I heard all the guitar parts that I'd never heard apart from on record. I mean, we could never do all those guitar parts with just the one guitar with Led Zeppelin. And it was fantastic. I was having such a great time. And Chris Robinson, well, I can't say enough about how brilliantly he sang, and I can't say enough about what a good band it was too. It was a band that I always really, really, really liked, and I'm right here in New York now, and we played the Roseland Ballroom here, and it was just scary. It was fantastic. So yeah, I had a great time with them, and hope they had a great time with me.
Jimmy Page, thanks very much for talking
today. Thanks very much. Okay, bye.
Guitarist Jimmy Page with Fresh Air guest host Barbara Bogave. Their interview was recorded last week while I was away. Led Zeppelin has a new 2-DVD set of concerts, interviews, and TV appearances. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Roberta Shurrock, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Leaves are falling all around. Time I was on my way. Thanks to you, I'm much obliged. Such a pleasant stay. But now it's time for me to go. The autumn moon lights my way. But now I smell the rain, and with it pain, and it's heading my way. Sometimes I grow so tired.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Easter Island, a novel about two women living 60 years apart by Jennifer Vanderbees. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the lifestyles of former dictators who are now in exile. We talk with journalist Ricardo Orizio about meeting and interviewing Idi Amin, Manuel Noriega, Jean-Claude Duvalier, and others. His new book is called Talk of the Devil. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.